Yeah, good morning. I'll call the Senate Finance Committee meeting to order. It's 9 o'clock. Please silence all phones. Today is Monday, March 25th, 2024. With me is Co-Chairman Hoffman, Co-Chairman Stedman, Senator Keel, Senator Merrick. The others will be along shortly. We have four bills on the agenda this morning: House Bill 193, Senate Bill 259, Senate Bill 113, and Senate Bill 73. The first bill up is House Bill 193, Internet for the Schools, by Representative Bryce Edgman. Please, we heard the companion bill last year. Representative Edgman, please come on up to the table. Go ahead and present the bill.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, committee members. For the record, my name is Bryce Edgman, representative for House District 37. The bill before you isn't really anything new. This bill has been through both bodies. It's been the subject of a joint session. But the version that's in front of you, House Bill 193, purports to do identically what last year's version, Senate Bill 140, proposed to do. And that is to take an existing state broadband program called the BAG program, Broadband Assistance Grant Program, that was started in 2014, that allowed schools to apply for matching money with the Federal Universal Services Program at the rate of 10 megabytes per second. That was back in 2014. 2020, that was increased to 25 megabytes per second. Mr. Chairman, what the bill in front of you proposes to do is keeping up with the times that schools need better internet services, particularly in far-flung areas, but to take that 25 megabytes and increase it to 100 megabytes per second. So the smaller schools that don't have the ability to have, whether it be fiber optic or any other means of getting faster internet services, can actually compete through an application process for matching monies of up to $9 on the federal end to $1 for the state end, and really be able to get a huge amount of federal money to help them get better internet services.
Remind me what that ratio is again?
It's approximately $9 on the federal end of things to $1 for every state dollar that goes forward.
9 to 1, that's significant. Go ahead.
Yes, it is. It is very significant. And the department is here to talk in more detail about the fiscal note, but admittedly, the fiscal note is not insignificant, but that but the fiscal note that's before the committee today assumes that every single applicant out there would be able to qualify and that the maximum amount would be drawn upon, when in reality, I don't think that that's going to be the case. The final point I would leave with the committee is that this issue is very time sensitive. In fact, we're looking at like 2 days until there's an absolute hard stop that the school would not be able to participate in this program vis-a-vis a federal deadline that expires on midnight on Wednesday. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I really appreciate the bill coming before the committee and the committee's indulgence in allowing me to present it.
Sure. I'd like to welcome Senator Wilson and Senator Bishop to the table. We were away on other state business while we started. With that, is there any committee discussion on this? No? Not, Senator? Is there a motion, Senator Hoffman?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move this, the House Bill 193, version 33-LSO817/A, be moved from the committee with individual recommendations attached, fiscal notes, to the next committee of referral.
So this bill passes out of Senate Finance without objection. With that, we'll take an at ease. Call the Senate Finance Committee meeting back to order. The next bill up is Senate Bill 259, Compensation for Certain State Employees by the Legislative Council. This is the first hearing. Senator Bree Jackson is away on other state business. We'll invite her aide, Jeff Stepp, to the table. Please introduce the bill. Identify yourself for the record. We'll go on from there.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jeff Stepp, and I'm staff to Senator L.V. Gray Jackson, Chair of Legislative Council. Senate Bill 259 before you, short titled Compensation for Certain State Employees, is legislation necessary to resolve an oversight contained within a section of House Bill 226, which passed the legislature in 2022. HB 226 included a provision meant to ensure state employees who are not covered by a bargaining unit receive salary adjustments in parity with those negotiated by the supervisory bargaining unit. However, due to the Department of Law's interpretation of that section, as detailed in a legal services memo included in your bill packet, the Department of Administration has been unable to implement these salary adjustments for approximately 2,800 exempt and partially exempt employees across the legislative, executive, and judicial branches. Senate Bill 259 seeks to solve the problem by providing clear and unambiguous authority to the Department of Administration to adjust salaries for exempt and partially exempt employees. This bill is not introducing a new concept. Rather, it is a necessary corrective measure to fulfill the original intent of that one section of HB 226 when it was supported by the legislature and became law 2 years ago. By amending AS 39-27-011M, SB 259 offers a streamlined approach to salary adjustments, eliminating the need for further legislative action for each salary schedule change. This not only expedites the process, but also ensures that our employees are compensated fairly. Moreover, the bill includes provisions for these adjustments to be retroactive to July 1st, 2023. Which is necessary to rectify the pay disparity experienced by affected employees since the passage of HB 226. The fiscal impact of the 1% cost of living adjustment, as noted in your fiscal note, is $4,177,000. Breaking that down, it's approximately $2.8 million for the executive branch, approximately $909,000 for the courts, and $521,000 for the legislature. Supplemental funding would be required to pay for this cost of living adjustment in fiscal year 24. Mr. Chairman, I'll do my best to answer the committee's questions. Better yet, we have professionals with expertise in personnel, HR, and finance from all three branches of government in the gallery. Plus, the bill drafter is available online for questions this morning. On behalf of Senator Gray Jackson, I would like to express my appreciation for your consideration of Senate Bill 259. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, co-chairs, and members of the committee.
Mr. Stepp, thank you very much for introducing this bill in a very concise manner. Do we have any discussion between the committee members on this bill? If not, we'll go ahead and set this bill aside. We'll take an at ease to get ready for the next bill. We'll call the Senate Finance Committee back to order. Our next bill up is Senate Bill 113, the REA Fund for Mount Edgecombe Teacher Housing by the Senate Finance Committee. We heard this bill last April 26th and took public testimony then. We'll have Tim Grusendorf, the Chief of Staff for Senator Hoffman, come on up to the committee and remind us what the bill does, what its effects are. Please identify yourself for the record and go ahead with your reminder.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Tim Grusendorf, staff to Senator Hoffman and the Senate Finance Committee. What Senate Bill 113 is proposing to do, currently the Department of Education uses the Regional Education Attendance Area and Small Municipal School District Fund for grants to school districts within the regional education attendance areas. SB 113 expands the eligibility uses of the fund for construction and major maintenance projects for Mount Edgecombe High School. For major maintenance on teacher housing and eligible areas that is owned by the district or by the state. And it also removes the cap on the size of the fund, which is currently sitting at $70 million. The reason this was brought before the Senate is Mount Edgecombe right now has to compete with all the other agencies within the state. I'm looking at it in your packet. You should have something that I pulled up off the Office of Management Budget's Deferred Maintenance Backlog Summary. And the total of that list is $2.1 billion in deferred maintenance through from all the departments, including the university. And in that is the Department of Education, and that Mount Edgecombe falls under that. So they're competing with other projects in agencies versus the school construction list, where all the other schools are housed. That list is about $500 million. Total of $260 million for construction and $249 million for major maintenance. So it seems a fairer way for Mount Edgecombe to be treated with all the other schools in a $500 million list of requests versus with all the other departments on a $2.1 billion list. And with that, that's pretty much what the bill is trying to accomplish.
Mr. Grusendorf, if I'm hearing you correctly, what they're doing is leveling the playing field so they can compete on the level as everybody else to go ahead and get funding for their
that is correct.
Educational needs.
That is correct.
Do we have any other members of the committee that have questions of the bill sponsor? If not, we'll go ahead and invite Karen Morrison, the Director of School Finance and Facilities, Department of Education and Early Development. Please come up to the table, identify yourself for the record. Go ahead with your presentation. We'll also have Lori Weed, the School Finance Manager, Department of Education, online to answer questions if we have any.
I'm here.
Oh, you're here. Okay.
Good morning.
Please identify yourself for the record.
For the record, my name is Karen Morrison, Director of Finance and Support Services for the Department of Education and Early Development.
And good morning. I am Lori Weed, School Finance Manager for the Department of Education and Early Development.
Would you address the fiscal note, please?
Of course. So this total fiscal note for Senate Bill 113, the REA Fund, Mount Edgecombe Teacher Housing, is $310,100. This bill amends Alaska Statute 1411025A to include Mount Edgecombe High School, also known as MEHS, as a funding recipient under the Regional Educational Attendance Area and Small Municipal School District School Fund. That's the REAA fund. This would also include funding teacher housing that is state-owned, located in, or provided to REAAs or small municipal schools. This bill amends Alaska Statute 1411030A to include Mount Edgecombe High School in major maintenance projects for teacher housing as eligible projects to receive an allocation from the REA fund. This bill also amends Alaska Statute 1411030B by removing the REAA's fund $70 million cap on the fund balance by adding Mount Edgecombe high school facilities and teacher housing as eligible allocations from the REA fund, which would increase the scope and number of facilities under the Department of Education and Early Development's purview. This would require additional staff expertise as it relates to residential dwelling sleeping units, design and construction considerations. To provide the additional expertise, DEED would need the following two positions: School Finance Specialist 2 at Range 18, Step BC, at $123,500, a Building Management Specialist at Range 19, Step BC, at $130,600. Additionally, on-site technical support and analysis would be needed to be provided so that these positions would be required to travel throughout the state. Each position would need two trips annually at $2,000 per trip, which is an $8,000 total. There are also support costs associated with establishing new positions, department chargebacks of $16,000 each per the position annually, so $32,000 total, as well as one-time supplies and equipment costs of $5,000 per position, that's $10,000 total. In fiscal 2025, there would also be a one-time increment of $6,000 that would be needed for legal service costs associated with revising and establishing new regulations.
Okay. Senator Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm fine with this piece of legislation. I just have a question for about DEED. In terms of their physical notes, every education bill we seem to get in the committee always has the same $6,000 increments for legal costs and establishing new regulations. But it seems like other departments just have this position filled and just someone that can just do this, but can do those costs. Is DEED just short staff, or we always contract this out to another agency or interagency receipts? Just don't understand why other departments have someone in house that can do this, because they get bills every single year that require these type of revisions and legal costs, and the DEED does not.
Lori Weed, for the record, through the chair, Senator Wilson. These are to address the legal chargebacks from Department of Law for review of the regulations and the process.
Senator Wilson.
Yeah, just wondering why DEED has them and Department of Health doesn't seem to have those. Commerce doesn't seem to have those. So is just DEED the redhead stepchild of the Department of Law?
Through the chair, I cannot speak to that, but our department budget is pretty lean, so perhaps the other.
Sarah Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Maybe it would be helpful to get a little background on how much law has charged in the last few years and correlate that to how many regs the board has done. I think the Board of Education Early Development varies a lot. Some years they put out a lot of reg packages, some years they put out a few. And it's not clear to me how we quantify what this reg package would cost compared to the baseline in the budget that doesn't vary each year.
Ms. Morrison.
For the record, this is Karen Morrison, Director of Finance and Support Services. That's a great question, Senator Keel, and I'm not sure of the answer, so I will have to follow up with you.
Follow-up, Senator Keel.
I have a different question, if I may, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. Can you tell us how many housing facilities are we looking at potentially applying here? What is the number we're looking at statewide? How did you get to this two full positions?
Ms. Morrison? Ms. Wood.
I'll speak to that. Thank you, sir. Through the chair, Senator Keel, this is Lori Weed. We don't have a current inventory of teacher housing in the state used by school districts, that because it hasn't been on our approved facility list, it's not something that we have maintained.
Follow up
without objection.
Thank you, Ms. Chairman. I'm curious how we got to the two positions is all. I think if I remember the org chart right, there are five folks in the facilities side, five PCNs in the facilities side now. And they are looking at potentially every school building in the state. Those are often, well, they vary from small school buildings to very large, complex structures with all the mechanical and ventilation, all things. And so my, I'm not in the building trades. My sense is that our housing units, teacher housing out in rural Alaska, are going to be smaller, less complex, and probably fewer of them. So can you help me with how we got to this is going to be a 40% bump in the workload, or at least 40% more positions?
Ms. Weed.
Thank you. Through the chairs, Senator Keel, Lori Weed for the record. Residential has a very distinct set of codes associated with it, which are very different from the school facility codes that we are currently accustomed to and have all of our support built to. So we will need at least the one additional position to speak to. Those codes have the technical expertise to meet that requirement to properly evaluate each of the projects.
Follow-up, Senator Will Keel.
No, thanks, Mr.
Brief at ease.
Brief at ease. Well, the Senate Finance Committee meeting back to order. I'd like to acknowledge that we have Senator Geisel in the audience that has been here from just the beginning. Welcome. Our next question comes from Senator Bishop.
Thank you. It's just a comment to either one of you two. Is this white paper came from you that talks about residential housing? Does that come from Deed? And it speaks to teacher and state and student housing is not currently under Deed's purview. Did you guys generate this? I just like to throw something out there. As long as I'm in full support of the bill, full support of adding this residential housing for teachers, et cetera, et cetera. I would just ask that reading the fiscal note, reading your white paper, that you reach out and interface with AHFC as they have been operating in this space for over 20 years. And to get some guidance and maybe not have to reinvent the wheel. There's a lot of knowledge there with the HFC. Thank you.
Just acknowledge that it did come from indeed the department.
Yes, through the chair.
It did come from the department. Okay. Any further discussion or questions? Oh, Senator Bush Stedman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just as a reminder, I think one of the several issues that brought this forward to the committee. last year we had major maintenance on schools in the capital budget. We also included some major maintenance for Mount Edgecombe at the same time, which was vetoed. And we were told that it was vetoed because we could be on the major maintenance list, which you can't be on the major maintenance list. That's why it wasn't on the major maintenance list. So it's a catch-22, so we're trying to clean this up. And I know we requested a clarification from the department on that veto. Did the committee get that?
I'm not sure that we ever did. It's certainly a reason for the legislation to come on through because of being kind of being the stepchild of the whole system, and that many of the leaders from the Native leaders from the past have gone to there and graduated from there. We have many more coming that are going to be replacing us. So it's important that we have this facility up and running. Senator Stedman.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. As in a follow-up, and this year, my understanding is there's $20-25 million in the budget governor's budget for maintenance, which we don't know the breakdown of that. Just the one lump sum could all go to wherever, right? So we don't have the ability here at the table to understand and get a grip on what is the maintenance expectation expenditures for this upcoming budget yet. So it is of great concern that, you know, we treat our schools equally around the state, and we need clarity on Mount Edgecombe. Also, I'd like to remind the committee that those kids or young Alaskans are living in World War II barracks. And they weren't built at the end of the war. They were built in the very early part or right before the war. So they're not going to last forever, and you're getting close here. In a few more years, it'll be 100 years. The other thing that concerns me greatly with Mount Edgecombe, it seems like when we ask for the major maintenance list needed at Edgecombe, it's very difficult to get. And sometimes it takes even a call from the senator in charge of the capital budget to get that list. So we need to change how this is structured, and that's the impetus of this bill. So the appropriators elected by the people can make the decision on what they feel should be dealt with maintenance of our rural schools. So, Mr. Chairman, I support this bill, and I hope we have support at the table to move it forward.
I want to recognize the representative from Sitka, Representative Kim Shute, who just came in to watch the bill. Any further questions by members of the committee for the Senate Bill 113? What's the will of the committee? Oh, I'm sorry, Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I might comment, you know, the students that graduate from Mount Edgecombe are graduating at some of the highest rates. The school, the state, I think, is very proud of the accomplishments of the school in spite of the conditions that exist there. And hopefully the department will find it somewhere to defend the improvements that will be included in this year's capital budget for those students. The conditions are despicable, and we need to change them. And I say that those students are graduating at some of the highest levels in spite of the lack of support from the Department of Education. So maybe if and when it comes to that time to defend those appropriations, you look hard and long at the deplorable conditions that exist in that facility, because those students deserve better. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any final comments or concerns on this bill by members of the committee, or any more comments by the two young ladies that are up in front of us?
To the chair.
I'm sorry?
To the chair. No, thank you.
Okay. What's the will of the committee?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Hoffman.
I move that Senate Finance Committee pass Senate Bill 113 from the committee with individual recommendations and attach fiscal notes to the next committee referral.
Without objection, Senate Bill 113 passes out of committee. Taking at ease. We'll call the Senate Finance Committee back to order. The next bill up is Senate Bill 73, Register Interior Designers by Senator Matt Klayman. This is the first hearing. Senator Klayman, please come on up to the table with your staff and go ahead with the presentation. Identify yourself for the record and go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and good afternoon, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Matt Klayman, and I'm the state senator for Senate District H in West Anchorage. And first, I want to thank you all for hearing Senate Bill 73. Senate Bill 73 makes an important change to our professional licensing statute to recognize the expertise of commercial interior designers and grant them the corresponding privileges. Every day, we work to make Alaska open and ready for business. The timeliness of this legislation to make Alaska open and ready for business is highlighted by the January 31st, 2023 request for proposals for the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers for the new Joint Integrated Test and Training Center at Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson. I'd also note that Senator Murkowski recently released a report of a variety of federal military projects that are in the coming up in the time ahead, and these are equally applied to what I'm talking about here. The construction cost for the J-Bear project is estimated by the Corps of Engineers to be between $100 million and $250 million. The RFP lists the primary selection criteria and the professional qualifications for design work, and they include architects and registered communications designers, a registered fire protection engineer, a registered interior designer, a registered mechanical engineer, a registered electrical engineer. There are a total of 13 professionals on the list in the RFP. This legislation will make it possible for an interior designer registered in Alaska to work on this important project for Alaska's infrastructure and our nation's defense. Without this legislation, responsive bids would have to contract with an interior designer who is registered in another state. The legislation provides better work opportunities for Alaskans. The requirements of this RFP reflect the direction for commercial design services in modern times. As a diverse profession, there are several different specialties under the title of interior designer. Among the most knowledgeable and highly trained are those who earned the National Council of Interior Design qualification. The NCIDQ, as it's called, is a three-part 11-hour examination that was established to identify interior design professionals with the skills and expertise to take on additional responsibility. This test is designed to assess the competency of candidates to protect the public through the practice of interior design and covers subjects such as fire safety, ADA compliance, emergency egress, and material flammability. A candidate unable to prove their understanding of life safety, codes, and standards would be unlikely to pass the exam. The goal is not to measure interior designers by the standards used by architects. While there are shared skill sets between architects and engineers, for architects and interior designers focus on a narrower scope of work. By comparison, there are different licensing requirements for physician assistants and doctors, even though they sometimes perform similar activities. The NCIDQ is rigorous and requires at a minimum 60 semester credit hours of post-secondary interior design coursework that encompasses a certificate, degree, or diploma from an accredited institution to sit for the exam. Currently, there's no state licensing of interior design in Alaska. One consequence of this license gap is that commercial interior designers do not have access to a construction stamp that would allow them to submit their work for permitting. Senate Bill 73 will allow Alaska to join other forward-looking states that have permitted certified commercial interior designers to have a construction stamp valid only for projects within their limited professional qualifications. Under Senate Bill 73, registered interior designers will be able to produce and stamp independent of an architect or engineer as authorized, but only as authorized by the AELS board. The practice of commercial interior design is specific and limited to non-load-bearing interior design elements, such as interior planning for occupant spaces, exiting, and specification of code-compliant interior finishes, furnishings, and fixtures. The scope of commercial interior design practice described in Senate Bill 73 is well within the competence of interior designers as determined by the education, by their education, training, and examination. Senate Bill 73 Crete will bring economic benefits by increasing professional employment opportunities, providing incentives to hire Alaskans for certified interior design, attracting high-quality design talent to the state, encouraging small business and unrestrained trade, and expanding consumer choices for qualified design professionals. Senate Bill 73 does not restrict the requirements or daily practice for any other professional in design or construction, including architects, engineers, contractors, tradespeople, decorators, or residential designers. Senate Bill 73 is intended to be cost neutral to the state, as it is self-funded within the AALS Registration Board through application, registration, and renewal fees. As shown in the attached fiscal note, the passage of this bill would enable the AALS Registration Board to hire a much-needed additional occupational license examiner, and the cost per licensee would only be an additional $50 every 2 years. With the passage of the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act, there will be approximately $1.2 trillion bringing opportunities for design professionals to work on public facility projects. The Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act will help provide many opportunities to rebuild our economy and strengthen the construction industry. And this bill will help get projects ready to build by having more professionals licensed in the field. We often talk of making Alaska open and ready for business. This bill turns those words into action and will make Alaska a better place to do business. Please join me in supporting Senate Bill 73. And before passing you off to my staff, Brianna Kakarik, for sectional analysis, please note that last year the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee sponsored Senate Bill 126, Architect Engineer Registration Board. Senate Bill 126 passed and became law last year, which changed some of the statutes we are referencing in this bill and referencing in the sectional. So if it's the will of the committee to continue hearing Senate Bill 73, it would need to adopt the changes that were brought on by the passage of Senate Bill 126. And with that, I will pass it off to my Chief of Staff, Brianna Kakarik, for the sectional analysis.
Do we have any questions from members of the committee for the bill sponsor? I guess, Senator Clayman, I do have one. How is this going to go ahead and affect the contractors that are doing work, especially out in rural Alaska, where you don't have access to people like interior designers that are out there? And this, go ahead.
The work that's currently going on, it would have no impact on present work because this would only affect work opportunities in the future. What it would mean for rural Alaska is anywhere else that if you're working on construction that would require, say, you're something bigger than a fourplex that's being built in rural Alaska, it would mean that in those contracts, the interior design work could be done by a registered interior designer, which would actually, in our evaluation, likely save costs on the project because it would allow certain work that's currently being done by architects to be done by interior designers that's within the scope of their professional practice.
But if I'm hearing the bill correctly, the requirement that you have a registered interior designer puts another obstacle in the way to get the project in. Is that not true?
I don't believe that this doesn't put a requirement to have the registered interior designer in the project. If it was a bill, for example, these defense RFPs, those contracts to apply, you actually have to have the registered interior designer. And what this would allow is that if you had an Alaska registered interior designer, that would allow you to use that registered interior designer in state to qualify for the project, which today you'd have to be hiring somebody from out of state that has the out of state certification to provide that qualification for the project.
And that was my next question. On the federal projects that are going on out there, they do require a licensed interior designer. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay. Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On exactly that point, Senator Clayman, there's a lot of interest in this bill. So someone brought by my office the U.S. Department of Defense spec, which calls for an interior designer when needed on a project to either be licensed by their state or have passed the NCIDQ. And they also brought by both the contract you mentioned and another one, U.S. Department of Defense for a large facility in Alaska, that said state licensed or pass the NCIDQ. So I guess the question is, for the one you mentioned that required state licensure, is the answer a bill or is the answer a phone call to the procurement officer saying, hey, you left something out here?
Senator Clayman.
I guess I'm not sure I'm tracking the question.
Can you rephrase the question again, Senator Keel?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The mil-spec doesn't require a state license. The mil-spec requires either a state license or the test.
Right.
So when there's a contract that requires a state license but doesn't allow for someone to pass the test, do we need then to create a state license, or do we need to call the procurement officer?
The claimant.
I'm not sure. The best answer I can provide is that what I see firms that are submitting bids are hiring or getting an interior designer that's registered in another state, because that's the way you show that you have the NCIDQ certification, is the license from another state. So that's what the firms are doing, is they're getting somebody that's licensed elsewhere to check that box.
No, Mr. Chairman, I can follow up later. Thanks.
And can you get a better answer for that question there, Senator Clayman?
Sure, we can we can certainly look into that, but that's been my understanding, is that the firms that are bidding are all getting registered, designers registered in another state.
Any further questions by members of the committee? Senator Merrick.
Thank you, Chair Olson. Senator Clayman, thanks for being here. Can you explain to me why they're joining this board as opposed to starting their own board?
Senator Clayman.
I think through the chair, Senator Merrick, they're not starting their own board because that would be far more expensive. And I think there's a real interest that they have the expertise that comes with having architects and engineers on the board to make sure their scope of practice is consistent with their expertise.
Follow up, Senator Merrick?
Nope. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any further questions by members of the committee for the bill sponsor? If not, Ms. Kakar, please identify yourself for the record and go ahead with your sectional analysis.
Thank you, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Brianna Kakarik, and I'm staff to Senator Clayman. Thank you for hearing Senate Bill 73. Section 1 would add two seats to the board, one for a commercial interior designer, a registered interior designer, and an additional engineering seat, creating separate seats for electrical and mechanical engineering, which currently share a seat. Section 2 would require the interior designer who sits on the board to be a registered interior designer. Section 3 would allow more than one electrical engineer or more than one mechanical engineer to serve simultaneously on the board if a member of the other profession is not available to fill the position designated for that profession. Section 4 would add registered interior designer examiners to the list for meetings. Board delegates may make expenditures to attend. Section 5 would add registered interior designers to the list of statistics the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development assembles relating to the performance of its staff and the performance of the board. Section 6 would add registered interior designers to the list of professional certificates the board may suspend, refuse to renew, or revoke. Section 7 would add registered interior designers to the list of applicants that can qualify for registration. Section 8 specifies that examination qualifications for a registered interior designer shall be established by the board and published in regulations. Section 9 would allow a person holding a certificate of registration authorizing the person to practice registered interior design in a state, territory, or possession of the United States, the District of Columbia, or a foreign country that, in the opinion of the board, meets the requirements of this chapter based on verified evidence, may upon application be registered in accordance with the regulations of the board. Section 10 would add registered interior designers to the list of registrants that must meet the stated application standards. Section 11 would add registered interior designers to the list of certificates of registration that may be awarded. Section 12 would add registered interior designers to the list of practices an individual holding a retired status registration may not practice. Section 13 adds registered interior designer a seal that can be obtained and that is not to be affixed to certain construction plans. Section 14 adds registered interior design to the list of services a corporation, limited liability company, or limited liability partnership may offer. Section 15 adds registered interior design to the list of practices the board can issue a certificate of authorization for. Section 16 adds registered interior design to a list of major branches. The certificate of authorization must specify. Section 17 adds a group of registered interior designers to the list of groups. The board may, in its own discretion, grant a certification of authorization to. Section 18 specifies that a corporation, limited liability company, or a limited liability partnership authorized to offer registered interior design is responsible to the same degree as the designated registered interior designer and shall conduct its business without misconduct or malpractice in the practice of registered interior design. Section 19 adds registered interior designer to the list of certificates the board may suspend or revoke. Section 20 adds registered interior design to the list of allowable practices a partnership of legally registered interior designers may engage in. Section 21 adds registered interior design to the list of practices a person may or may not engage in unless they are a registered interior designer. Section 22 specifies that this chapter does not prohibit the practice of registered interior design by a person who is not registered to practice registered interior design if the services are being performed by a person acting within the scope of practice authorized by another license that is held by that person, such as an architect. Section 23 specifies that a person who practices or offers to practice registered interior design in a state without being registered or authorized to practice is guilty of a misdemeanor and upon conviction is punishable by a fine of no more than $10,000 or by imprisonment for not more than 1 year or by both. Section 24 specifies if a person who practices or offers to practice registered interior design in the state without being registered or authorized to practice, the board may enter an order levying a civil penalty. Section 25 specifies that the right to engage in the practice of registered interior design is considered a personal and individual right based on the qualifications of the individual as evidenced by the individual's certificate of registration, which is not transferable. Section 26 defines evidence of practice pursuant to the sections prohibiting practice by non-registered individuals. Section 27 adds registered interior designer to the list of necessary exemptions. Of note, new subsection 15 is not subject to the regulations specifically stating that kitchen and bath design in exemption are exempted in residential structures per the National Industries request. Section 28 adds requirements to register as an interior designer only applies to practice that the board finds affect the public health, safety, or welfare. Section 29 adds interior designers as a professional service to the definition of certificate of authorization. Section 30 adds new subsection 24 and 25 defining the practice of interior design and registered interior designer. Section 31 adds registered interior design or landscape architecture to the definition of design professionals. Section 32 makes a technical change to subsection 1 and adds interior design to a list of services that a person may have a lien on to secure payment. Section 33 adds interior design to the list of professional services in connection with the construction of a public work performed by a state department. Section 34 adds registered interior design to the list of services that a procurement officer may award. Section 35 adds registered interior designers to the list of services to which a procurement officer may add a price as a factor in awarding a contract. Section 36 amends the statute to prohibit the state or municipality from awarding contracts to individuals, qualified partnerships, and an authorized corporation who are not registered to provide interior design. Section 37 clarifies that there's a grace period until July 1st, 2025 for currently practicing interior designers to become registered. Section 38 adds new transitional language requiring the interior designer appointed to the board be certified by the Council for Interior Design Qualifications and have resided in the state for at least 3 years immediately presiding appointment. Additionally, allows for an interior designer to hold the board seat until a registered interior designer is appointed to the seat, subject to meeting certain requirements. Section 39 provides the necessary regulations may be developed immediately for implementation. Section 40 clarifies that Section 1, 37, and 38 take immediate effect, and Section 41 provides an effective date. Thank you.
Senator Merrick has a question.
Thank you, Chair Olson. Through the chair, Senator Klayman, the summary of changes from version S to version D mentions the working group that was included both the architects and interior designers. And it says the architects and interior designers came to consensus agreement on amendments for Senate Bill 73, and this version incorporates these as agreed upon by the working group. If there was a lot of consensus, why am I hearing so much opposition still?
Senator Klayman.
Through the chair, Senator Merrick, we worked to try to address all of the objections that a group of architects had raised, and some of those objections we either couldn't reach agreement on at some level. The architects don't want the interior designers to have stamping authority for anything, and there were other changes that were suggested by the architects that we got an analysis from Ledge Legal that some of the suggestions actually didn't make any sense and that were conflicting with other changes that we've made in response to those requests.
Follow-up, Senator Merrick?
No follow-up. Thank you, Chair.
Any further questions by members of the committee? Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A question on Section 27 of the bill with the kitchen and bath exemption. It looks like it only applies to things that are already completely exempt from the whole chapter. Why are we exempting kitchens and baths and structures that are already completely exempt?
Senator Klayman.
The kitchen and bath, through the chair, Senator Keel, the kitchen and bath section was added specifically because there really is in the business world, there's this whole subset of folks that all they really do is kitchens and baths. They come into homes, they make recommendations that are almost all non-structural. This is the kind of stove you should have. This is the sink you should have. There are some design things, but they are very, very rarely structural. And then even that, they're in single-family homes that are also exempt. But this was a request made by that part of the industry that specifically wanted to be identified as a subspecialty that would not be covered by this new law.
Follow-up, Senator Gill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess I'm not clear on what function it serves, if it's only applicable to structures that are completely exempt. But maybe we could move to another element of the bill.
objection.
I think the part that has me a little confused when there is great dissension among the experts in the field, the interior designers, the architects, et cetera, is what exactly we're talking about in the technical specs and where we get to the reasons we regulate, right? Health and safety. And so when I look at the bill, and of course I don't have the section in front of me, but I think the board is going to set what the scope of practice is, right? The board is going to say what services, if this passes, a registered interior designer can stamp and can't stamp and the like. Can you fill us in on what those will be?
Through the chair, Senator Keel, this is not the first year that this legislation has been before the legislature. And in the earlier versions of the legislation, we worked to try to define specifically in the statute what the scope of practice would be for registered interior designers. And as part of the discussion that has been going on with architects and interior designers, in part that was part of my response to Senator Merrick, this bill changed the approach. Instead of trying to legislate or to define the exact scope of health, safety, and welfare things that the board would decide were permissible for interior designers to work on in the registered qualification, we changed the approach and basically are going to leave that to the board to decide. Within the bill, there's a lot of descriptions of the kinds of things that would be, and it's essentially non-structural things I discussed in my opening remarks. But the interest is to not try to ask the legislature to understand all the details of the design, but instead to rely on a diverse board that actually has substantial design and engineering expertise to be able to define the scope of practice. And that's the goal of the bill, is not to make the legislature make that decision, but instead rely on the ALS board to define their scope of practice. And that, from the designer's perspective, was one of their major concessions to try to reach consensus on the legislation.
Follow-up, Senator Keel.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. So does the board support this approach?
Senator Klayman.
The AALS board, through the chair, Senator Keel, I believe in a prior version of the bill before this version, there was a vote on the AALS board by, I think, a one-vote margin in which they don't support the legislation.
Thank you.
Any further questions by members of the committee for the bill sponsor? If not, we'll go ahead and go on to invited testimony. The first one up is Mr. C.B. Bettesworth, founder of Bettesworth North. He's on the line, please. Mr. Bettesworth, are you on, sir? You can see that you're on.
Can you hear me?
Mr. Bettesworth, go ahead and identify yourself for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Yes, for the record, my name is Charles Bettesworth. I'm an architect, co-chairs, members of the committee. Thank you so much for hearing me speak on Senate Bill 73. I'm a registered architect, and I've practiced in Alaska for over 50 years. 40 years ago, I founded Bettesworth North Architects and Planners, a multidisciplinary firm providing design service in architecture, landscape architecture, and interior design. I strongly support the passage of HB 159. I've been a supporter of this initiative for several years and encourage the Senate Finance Committee to pass Senate Bill 73. Among the many reasons I support this legislation are the following. First, I recognize the very good explanation that Senator Klayman made with respect to the requirement of the Corps of Engineers to require registered interior designers for projects that they are currently sending out RFPs for. Secondly, currently in Alaska, architectural firms hire interior designers who are not registered and do not seal the documents that they prepare. Architects who hire these designers then seal those documents and assume all liability. With registered interior designers, architects can and will hire the registered design professionals who will seal those documents, thereby reducing the liability to the architects. That concludes my testimony, and thank you for hearing this legislation.
Do we have any questions for Mr. Bettesworth this morning? I don't see anything. Mr. Bettesworth, thank you very much for coming out.
Thank you.
Next, we have Dana Nunn, American Society for Interior Designers, Alaska Chapter. Please, are you on, ma'am?
Good morning, I am. Thank you.
Please identify yourself for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Dana Nunn, Mr. Chairman, co-chairs, and members of the committee. I am a 20-year Anchorage resident and an NCADQ certified interior designer. I'm here to express my support of SB 73 personally and as a representative of the American Society of Interior Designers and the International Interior Design Association, of which Alaskan interior designers are members. I did have some testimony prepared, but I think my time would be best spent answering some of the questions that just came to light recently. So I will start first with a question regarding impact to rural contractors and those sorts of projects. SB 73 does not require that clients, building owners, or general contractors hire a registered interior designer. SB 73 simply provides greater consumer choice when a project scope requires a registered professional, and that scope of work aligns with the limited scope of work of a registered interior designer. The consumer now may choose a registered architect or a registered interior designer. A perfect example would be a number of projects I have been personally working on in Nome, Alaska, over the last several years, Many of them were larger projects that required an architect because we were doing structural things. We were changing occupancy or completely repurposing a facility. But several of them were simply interior tenant improvements, things to make patient rooms safer in the regional hospital, updates to the patient hostel, things like that. And because the state does not allow me to become registered and does not allow an insured buyer to take responsibility for that work had to be overseen by an architect, despite my specialized expertise in interior design and design for health environments. Regarding DOD contracts, let's be clear that the standalone specs from the federal government are not all that apply to a contract. Plainly, if a project scope includes that of comprehensive interior design, then the designer of record for that scope must be NCIDQ certified in accordance with the Whole Building Design Guide and UFC 3-120-10, which we've acknowledged earlier today. Further, fundamental RFP requirements for key personnel capabilities and experience have required for at least the past 8 years that all designers of record on a project must be registered, no matter the discipline. All RFPs, the solicitation and the referenced requirements of the Whole Building Design Guide and the UFC are not mutually exclusive. Rather, the most stringent combination of requirements applies, whether to the design team composition or for the design of the project itself. Thus, the designer of record for the comprehensive interior design scope of work may be a registered architect who has passed the NCIDQ, of which there are only a few in Alaska that I'm aware, and only one that tends to pursue this kind of work, or that work may be completed by a registered interior designer, which by definition has passed the NCIDQ and must be registered in another state because Alaska has no registration. And then the requirements in the RFP solicitation itself go on to say that if you are not registered in Alaska, then you must have 5 years Alaska climate zone experience. I myself have carried professional registration outside of Alaska since 2008, specifically to meet this requirement on military projects. Regarding the question about the combined board, the Interorganizational Council on Regulation, or ICOR, is comprised of the four regulatory organizations for the design professions, and it was formed almost two decades ago to discuss their complementary focus on advocating on behalf of public protection role their regulatory boards play. As nonprofit associations, membership in ICOR is comprised of these boards whose functions include licensing and other credentialing for architecture, engineering, interior design, landscape architecture, and surveying. In many jurisdictions, these professions are overseen by the same board, much like the AELS oversees all design professions currently regulated in Alaska. In May of last year, the ICOR published a joint statement. Due to the commonalities in regulation and practice, as well as the profound impact on the public and environment, we unequivocally support the continued licensure of architecture, engineering, interior design, landscape architecture, and surveying. And their joint statement concluded, oversight of these professions is essential to protecting the public's health, safety, and welfare while minimizing the risks associated with technical design professions. Including interior design under the same body offers operational efficiency and regulatory consistency across the related disciplines. There was a question regarding the definition of the scope of practice, and Senator Klayman was correct that it was through the 9 meetings over 18 months, comprising more than 30 hours of working group time with AIA, that it was determined that we pull definition of scope of practice out of the proposed bill language because it is more appropriately handled within the regulatory realm that the board would have purview over. But I can share that some of the things we have talked about would be that the scope of practice of interior designers that are registered would be non-structural in nature. They would not have impact change of occupancy of buildings. There would not be change to overall building ecosystems, but interior designers would be allowed within discrete areas of the building to modify and revise egress up to the connection with that building system. Those are some of the gray areas between interior design and architecture that we've discussed. Finally, related to AELS support, it was recently determined in minutes for the most current AELS board that the AELS currently takes a neutral position regarding Senate Bill 73 and House Bill 59. And so with that, I simply ask you to now protect Alaskans and bolster our economy by keeping our workforce strong and competitive. Please support Senate Bill 73, and I am happy to answer any additional questions you may have.
Do we have any additional questions for Ms. Nunn by members of the committee? If not, thank you very much for coming out this morning.
Certainly. Thank you.
The next invited testimony is Jessica Cederberg, president of the American Institute of Architects Alaska Chapter. Ms. Cederberg, are you on, ma'am?
Yes, I am. Good morning, Senators. My name is Jessica Cederberg, and I am a lifelong Alaskan and licensed architect with over 30 years of practice. I serve as the president of the American Institute of Architects Alaska Chapter, and we oppose SB 73. For the past 4 years, we have rigorously reviewed interior design regulation bills. We have taken every possible opportunity to make changes to SB 73 that are best in the interest of the state's consumers, construction industry, and design professional community. Because the sponsor of this bill has been unwilling to make changes that would make it palatable, the version you have before you does not represent consensus. We respectfully disagree with Senator Klayman's interpretations of our working group meetings. The major problems with SB 73 are, one, it segregates certain types of interior designers from others that do not have the same qualifications. It provides an exclusive right to 21 people, creating a class of people who have privilege and access above others who are equally qualified and capable. Two, the bill adds two more seats to the Architects, Engineers, and Land Surveyors Board, which is already the largest state licensing board. But most importantly, it disregards the recommendations of the AELS board. The vast majority of services that interior designers perform are not related to health and safety of the public. While they have many excellent skills, their work does not rise to the responsibility and liability to the public that is undertaken by other regulated design professionals. Three, the bill is excessively broad and fails to create a lane that can be clearly understood as a legal limit of practice. For example, Section 30 of this bill, Item 24, reads, the practice of registered interior design means a professional service or creative work in the design of interior spaces. This broad definition invites unqualified practice, especially in fire and life safety systems, which in turn is a direct threat to the public safety. Bottom line, this legislation is unnecessary. The current regulation design professionals works well, and interior designers are successfully working around the state. The 21 people who have NCIDQ certification are already able to compete on federal contracts. A license to practice in Alaska is not a requirement of these core contracts. While some federal agencies encourage or require NCIDQ certification for portions of the projects that contain interior design, state regulation of the NCID certificate is not a federal requirement. There are federally funded projects in every state, yet only two states regulate the practice of interior design. If a state interior design license were required to perform these federal projects, the interior designers in most states would not even be eligible. A simple call to the procurement officer resolves this issue. And finally, if you feel that regulation is needed, there are other options that will give professional recognition that interior designers seek without being erroneous. Please do not move this bill out of committee. Please send us all back to the drawing board to work in a truly collaborative way to find a solution that aligns Alaska with 27 of the other states who regulate interior design. Thank you very much for the opportunity to speak and your time and consideration today.
Ms. Cederberg, we have a question by Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Cederberg, thanks for your testimony. You said that the bill would leave out folks who have equivalent qualifications to those who passed the NCIDQ? What folks are there? What other methods are there of showing the same qualifications?
Ms. Cederberg.
Thank you, Senator Klayman. There's actually other exams within the interior design practice that they can take, such as ASID is one of them. I need, I can get back with you for the other testing options that are available to the public for the interior design.
Ms. Cederberg, that was actually Senator Keel, not Senator Klayman.
Oh, sorry, Keel.
No, no problem, and we'll be sending this bill aside, so if you can get back to us with the answer to Senator Keel's question.
Thank you.
Any further questions by members of the committee for Ms. Cederberg? Ms. Cederberg, one of the questions I do have is under Section 31, where you have the immunity for the third-party design professionals. Are you in agreement with that section there in the bill?
Is somebody available to read that section for me?
If you don't have a copy of it, we'll go ahead and try and get you a copy, but I'll ask the bill sponsor to go ahead and take a look at that and answer the question.
Okay.
If there's no other questions from Ms. Cederberg by members of the committee, thank you very much for coming out this morning.
Thank you.
I'd like to go ahead and call up the bill sponsor and his chief of staff and answer some of the concerns that Ms. Cederberg brought out related to, I guess there was four of them, which would segregate the interior designers. Some of the issues that were there were not related to health and safety. The excessively portion of unqualified practice, and only two other states require this designation for their construction operations.
Okay.
I can start at the beginning.
If you want to give me one question at a time.
Okay. Because she started out that stating that Senate Bill 73 would segregate interior designers so that you would go ahead and make it so that some people were not eligible to go ahead and work where they've been working for many years. Is that true?
Mr. Chair, I don't believe that is true. There's actually an amendment in the House version of the bill. There's a minor amendment to one section of the bill that was in response to questions about folks that have been working in interior design but are not interested in stamping drawings. And that is in section, hold on. That's in section 27 of the bill, subsection 8, that we would be recommending adding the word construction on line 26, actually on line 25, so it would read, or other data for alterations, comma, construction or repairs to a building, and that would make it, that would clarify the concern that had been raised by a interior designer who did not want to become registered and doesn't have NCIDQ qualifications.
Okay. The next one was by adding two more seats to the board. This is really unrelated to the health and safety of the work that they do. Is that a concern at all?
The additional seats were one, Mr. Chair, one was to have a registered interior designer on the board so that the discussion that would go on the board level about what was the appropriate scope of practice, they'd have an interior designer that would be part of those discussions. And then the other additional seat is to add a second engineer so that instead of having a mechanical engineer and an electrical engineer in a single seat, it would add a second seat so there would be a specifically designated mechanical engineer and a specifically designated electrical engineer. Our understanding is the board had, at times, members of the board had expressed some interest in having that additional seat so that you actually always had that expertise in the board. And so that was the reason to add the second seat, to basically create two engineer seats where there's currently just one.
Okay.
And I don't see how either of those additions would if anything, it would enhance the ability of the board to meaningfully analyze questions about scope of practice and other technical things.
Sure. And I think the last one was had to do with, I mean, I heard it incorrectly, there are only two other states that have this requirement for an interior designer to have that qualification.
My understanding is that several states, Mr. Chair, have passed what we call title acts as opposed to practice acts. The title acts allow somebody to use the title but doesn't give them the stamping authority. Mm-hmm. And the practice act is what allows the stamping authority. And I would need to get back to you. I know there's other states that are taking up this question, and so I want to get back to you about the number of states and how that breaks down. I do think it's true that today there's more states with a title act than with a practice act. I think in terms of accessibility to the public, I think there's a real interest in the industry in the construction industry be able to hire interior designers to stamp documents within their scope of practice, because I think that ends up saving money overall in the construction process.
Okay. Any further questions by members of the committee for the bill sponsor? Oh, Senator Bishop.
Thank you. Senator Klayman, good to see you here this morning. Do you have a feel for how many architectural firms have interior designers working inside their firm that support this legislation or oppose this legislation?
Senator Klayman.
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, I don't have a sense of numbers. My general sense is that when you get to a pretty small size architect's office, meaning more than just two or three, there's almost always an interior designer on the team because there's just a level of practice that they're very good at, and the architects like having them there. And so when you go to architecture's offices, they have interior designers. And some of that is actually, my mother was an architect, and she worked in relatively small architect's offices, usually less than 10 total people, and no matter what, there was always an interior designer on the team.
Follow up, Senator Bishop.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for that question. Senator Merrick.
Thank you, Chair Olson. Through the chair, Senator Klayman, one of the objections I've heard from the architects is they do not want to have to bear the costs of including the interior designers. And in AS0801065F, it says that all occupations regulated by this board must be charged the same fee. Are the interior designers, would they be willing to pay an increased fee to help cover some of these regulations and different costs to the board by having them added?
Senator Klayman.
I'll have to get back to you on that. My understanding is that I think my testimony had said that the anticipated increase in fees related to this legislation would be about a $50 addition to the fees every 2 years. But I don't think that addresses the question you just asked, and I'll get back to you.
Thank you.
Any further questions by members of the committee for the bill sponsor? The last question we have has to do with the fiscal note. Do you want to address that, or shall we have Ms. Robb from the, who's the director of the Division of Corporations, come on up and address it?
Question about fiscal note, since it's theirs, I think she should answer.
Okay. Thank you very much for coming out this morning.
Thank you again, Mr. Chair.
Ms. Robb, please come on up and identify yourself and clarify what the fiscal note is. There seems to be some questions there as to whether it's going to be saving money for the end user that's paying for the construction, whether it's federal or otherwise, and those kind of concerns that we all have.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Sylvan Robb, Director of the Division of Corporations, Business and Professional Licensing. Mr. Chair, just looking at the fiscal note as it's written, beginning in FY25, the division has costs of $157,100. That's almost all related to the cost of adding an additional occupational licensing examiner. And you will see that decreases in the out years. By about $17,000. That decrease is from costs in the first year that are related to commodities for that new employee, as well as the regulations projects that would be associated with this. And all of these costs would be paid through DGF 1156 fund, which is receipt supported services. So it would come from the fees paid by licensees.
So as you look at the end user, who's the person, the private person that may be contracting or having a contractor out there, is that going to save him money or is that going to cost him money to have a licensed person that can stamp papers?
Mr. Chair, that's a bit down the road from the work we do. You know, certainly people include the costs of operating their business, and one of those would be if they have one of these registered interior designers, you know, covering the cost of that individual would be passed on. But it's not, this is a large pool of licensees. Currently, the board licenses nearly 8,000 individuals and firms, and so. The relative cost compared to the pool of licensees may not be that large.
Senator Stemmer has a question.
Yes, Ms. Robb, can you help me with the department's view of this bill, why it's needed or if it's not needed, if the department supports it or don't support it? Because I would expect, you know, as the director under professional licensing, you'd have an opinion on the need for this bill. I'd like to hear it, please.
Yes.
Through the chair, Senator Stedman, the department is neutral on this bill. You know, the need to regulate interior designers is more of a policy call. We would defer to the will of the board as well as the will of the legislature on whether there's a public safety need for this.
Bob, Senator Stedman.
Just to follow up, so there's a neutral position on the board or no position, but do we have problems within the construction industry warranting this, or is it's just a turf fight between two professional groups? Or do you get any complaints on this? Can you give us any background at all on it?
Ms. Robb, please.
Through the chair, Senator Stedman, the complaints that the division typically receives are related to our licensees, and as interior designers are not currently a licensed profession, if people did make a complaint, and I'm not aware of any, we would let those individuals know that it wasn't jurisdictional for us at this point because those are not individuals that we regulate.
So if I hear you correctly, it is not necessarily required for health and safety of people that are out there. Is that your evaluation?
Mr. Chair, we would defer to professionals in this field as to whether this is a requirement.
Follow-up, Senator Stemmer. Senator Click Bishop.
Thank you. Ms. Robb, good morning. To your answer to Senator Stedman's question, I'm not going to assume anything, but I'm going to say this. I would assume if you get a complaint for a licensed individual, there's in that complaint, there is something that is triggering that complaint. Is it the interior design piece? The carpet's the wrong carpet and it stinks and it gives my employees headaches? Or do you get that granular when you're looking at these complaints? And do you keep a track of those?
Ms. Robb.
Thank you. Through the chair, Senator Bishop. So the types of complaints that we typically receive that would be jurisdictional, something that we would take action on and investigate and then pass to the board to determine if licensing action was needed, are typically related to scope of practice. So if people have gone beyond the scope of what they're authorized to do through their license, if we see people who are operating unlicensed, not something that we typically see with this board, but then other disciplinary issues that typically tend to come up are failure to complete the continuing education requirements in order to renew a license.
Follow-up, Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Mr. Wilson.
Yes, thank you. Solomon Rupp, a little confused on the answer you gave, Senator Stedman, that you said the department is not does not have a position, but the board did have a position on this piece of legislation. And then I believe the bill sponsor said it sort of failed to support this piece of legislation by one vote. And my question comes into what type of hostility would that sort of bring into a board dynamic to be forced to take on a piece of legislation that they don't want to or did not support? Do you feel that, or just in the experience in terms of regulation packages would be sort of neutral to the incoming industry, or will it bring more hostility to the board, or how does the board normally operate when sort of you now institute a board of a 13-member board and the one seat's a minority seat on that board, and how that plays out?
Ms. Robb, is that indeed true that the board failed to go ahead and support the legislation initially?
Mr. Chair, we do have the former past chair here to speak for the board, and she is still the designated spokesperson from the board. I don't know if that was the committee's interest in hearing from her today.
Before we go on, can you answer Senator Wilson's question, though?
Yes, through the chair, Senator Wilson. Certainly having a seat added to the board where there may not be overwhelming interest and support for the addition of that profession and individual to the board, is going to create a less collegial working environment than a board, if the board had sought to have this seat and profession added to the scope of what they regulate. But certainly we've also seen, personality clashes on boards in the past, and we try to assist boards to work through those and ensure that they can still continue to function.
Well, Senator Wilson?
No, thank you. I was just looking for that letter in our packets and lots of letters.
Senator Q.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Robb, we heard testimony that this might be as few as two dozen folks. And I noticed that the division seems to think there will be more. I see there's a need for an additional occupational licensing examiner. What's your estimate of how many folks will take advantage of this new new registration?
Ms. Robb.
Through the chair, Senator Keel. As clear, we don't register interior designers now, so we don't have a good sense of how many folks there are. Additionally, I think one of the earlier invited testifiers mentioned that there were a couple dozen folks who currently have that NCIADQ certification. We anticipate that more people, may be interested in seeking that, given that if this legislation were to pass, this opens the door to additional practice authority with that registration. So in terms of a crystal ball to predict how many folks may be interested, it's hard to say with great specificity.
Bob, Senator Keel?
Just maybe a general question. What is the average number of regulated professionals per licensing examiner in the division these days?
Ms. Robb.
Through the chair, Senator Keel, there really isn't an easy answer to that question because the degree of complexity for different professions and what's required to obtain a license or registration varies greatly. So when we get an application for a physician, maybe a radiologist who practices telemedicine in 50 states where we need to check that they haven't had any licensure action in all 50 of those states, that is obviously a much more complex application for the licensing examiners to review than an application to be a manicurist.
Bob, Senator Gill?
No, thank you.
We're caught on that ease. Senate Finance Committee back to order. There has been a reference to the vote that was taken by the board, and we happen to have the former board chair here, Ms. Catherine Fritz, who was there during that vote. Ms. Fritz, would you mind coming on up and just kind of clearing us up? Because there's been my understanding that there was a vote taken that may have had one result, and then there was a later vote that was taken that may have had another result. Could you just clear up those two transpirations that may have happened? And please identify yourself for the record and go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Catherine Fritz, and I am the former chair of your AALS board, served up until the 29th of February, and you will you'll have a different person running your AALS board at this point. You have in your packet, I believe that Senator Wilson was trying to find the letter from the board. I actually sent it first to this committee in July. So it's dated July 23rd. It's on Department of Commerce letterhead. And it talks about actions from the May 2023 meeting of the board. At that meeting, the board voted to recommend against adding interior design to its responsibilities. The way the bill, the motion was made, being encouraged to make a motion in the positive, board member Bob Bell presented it as a motion to add interior design to the board, and then he quickly spoke against the motion, and a vote was made and it failed. The vote failed, and this confusion is what I think is being referred to today, because it was presented in the positive and it failed. There is some interpretation that means the board remains neutral. There was no second vote. There has not been another vote on that matter.
Okay. So it's my understanding that Mr. Bell put the objection forward and that vote failed, meaning that they did not support having interior designers on being part of the board.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, slight clarification, if I heard you correctly. He put a motion to approve the addition, and that motion failed. So with the implication and the discussion during that motion that there was not sufficient support for interior design to be added. Then there was a second part in that letter that you'll read. There were some specific recommendations that if the legislature feels that regulation or SB 73 should move forward, there were some specific recommendations of, you know, of modifications they would request be made.
Follow-up, Senator Wilson?
No, Mr. Chair.
Any further questions from Mr. Fritz? Not, thank you very much for coming up this morning.
Thank you.
I'm sorry, Senator Wilson.
No, I guess the bill sponsor could answer the question, Mr. Chair.
Senator Clayman and Ms. Kakar, please come on up.
Just wondering, then, were the references that were listed in the letter from the department, or I guess from this from the board, were those addressed in terms of amendments, or is this CS?
Want to take it at ease, Senator Clayman?
Please, Mr. Chair.
come back on the record. Senator Klayman, there was a question for the bill sponsor. Could you help us with that question before we set this bill aside, please?
Sure. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. There were four issues on paragraph two of the letter that came from the ALS board. The first was remove all references in the bill to sections 1, 2, 3, and 38. And those are all the sections that relate to the makeup of the board. And so they're objecting to, essentially they're objecting to adding the additional seats to the board, both the engineer seat and the interior design. Remove section 15 or section 27. That's the section that we talked about earlier about kitchen design. And that's still part of the bill. Section 30 is also stayed in the bill. That was after a fairly detailed discussion with legislative legal about what that section does in terms of the scope of practice. And for the reasons that we learned from LegLegal, it makes sense to keep it in, and we can provide more detail. And then I think section 37, that again is based on the concept that there's not an interior designer on the board. So that wouldn't be necessary if you didn't have an interior designer on the board. So they're all related to their objection to an interior designer on the board.
Paulo? Thank you very much for coming out this morning. We're going to set this bill aside. If there's no further questions, this concludes our agenda for this morning. Our next hearing will be tomorrow at 9 a.m., hearing update on the federal infrastructure funding. There's nothing to come before the committee. We're adjourned at 10:50 a.m. Thank you.